Welcome to the South Shore's Morning News Weekend Review Podcast. I'm Rob Hackelall. Listen for the next 30 minutes as we take a look back at some of the big interviews from the week on the South Shore's Morning News, which airs live weekdays from 5 to 10 a.m. Oh, he is indeed our favorite banker, Mr. Bob Terabecchia. On the South Shore's Morning News, this segment is sponsored by Coastal Heritage Bank. Coastal Heritage Bank, all around the area and beyond. One community, many individuals, one bank that's perfect for you. Coastal Heritage Bank, growing together, member FDIC, member DIF. Bob is the chair and CEO of Coastal Heritage Bank. Hi, Bob.
Morning, folks.
This morning you do have an interesting topic for us.
Yeah, I think so. It seems mundane, but I'll tell you, the more I dug into it, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently just about paying in cash. And the premise was using high denomination bills and how it's difficult to negotiate these nowadays. And I started doing just thinking about it as I read the article, and then I just wanted to do some research about, you know, how prevalent is the use of cash in American society from person-to-person payments, you know, from a day-to-day basis. But I have a question for both you and Christine, because this surprised me, and maybe I'm just clueless and it's obvious to everybody else. As you know, there are $7 denominations of paper currency in circulation. So there's the $1 bill, the $2, the $5, the $10, $20, $50, and $100, right?
Yep.
So those are the seven. Of those seven denominations, in terms of the number of bills out there, which one is the most prevalent?
Do you think it's the 20?
20s.
20? That's a
not
guess.
Not the one? What do you think?
That's a good one. I don't know. I'm just going to go with 20s because it seems like the only thing you can get out of a machine.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what it is?
What?
The 100.
Oh.
Is that Las Vegas?
There are almost 19 billion $100 bills in circulation as of 2022. My reference here is the Federal Reserve, if anyone wants to fact check me, 2022. And the second most popular is not the 20.
The 50?
What do you think it is?
Is it the 50?
The one.
Oh.
The $1 bill.
And it's impossible to find $5 bills. I'm just saying that.
Correct. Yeah, $5 bills are only $3.5 billion. In $20, just to round it out a little bit, is $11.5 billion. When you add up the value of all of those bills, this is mind-boggling, because I didn't even know. I'm like, oh, I never thought about it. Like, if you took, there's a graph at the Federal Reserve, and it shows in billions how many of each of these denominations are in circulation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's 54 billion of these things floating around the world, and the value, and I won't torture you, the value is about $2.5 trillion in value out there.
Wow.
You know, so there is, and this is another fact that I was blown away by. Roughly half of those dollars are circulated outside of the United States.
Oh my.
So there's about $1 trillion U.S. dollars in all denominations, ones, twos, fives, you know, so forth, that are floating around the world.
Going on a trip.
Right? Going on a trip.
Right.
They may never come home.
Maybe a one-way trip.
Did they say where those overseas dollars are? I mean, you think some gazillionaire in Qatar gives a cab driver a $100 tip. I'm just thinking of that. I mean, seriously.
Well, no, I mean, a lot of people still, right, use the American money in other countries. I've seen
absolutely.
That happen.
Yeah,
no, because they're legal tender and you don't know who has them, right? That's the beauty of cash in some respects, is that it's private, right? If I mowed your lawn and you gave me $20, nobody knows, right? I mean, nobody knows what you gave me. It's between us, so we don't really know, Christine. It's a good question. I think we could hazard to say where some of it is. You know, I think a lot of that, and I don't have a tinfoil hat. I think a lot of that's floated around by the CIA, when they do this, when they do their business around the world.
Probably a good idea.
That's how they pay people, right?
$100 bills. I mean, they do. They've always talked about stacks of cash used for certain things, and then the rich guys they use them to light their cigars. You see that?
It's always legal tender. And Bob, I think I shared this story with you before, but my brother-in-law, who's passed away, used to allegedly work for the U.S. Treasury Department, although he was always in areas like Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Tbilisi, Georgia, and one of those other Stan countries. And I used to say, well, what's the deal? He goes, I have to border at least one NATO country where I can be put in the trunk of a car and pay $5,000 in U.S. dollars to get out. He goes, I'll never do crypto. That made an impression on me, Bob. I just wanted to mention that to you.
Yeah. You've never been big on crypto.
No, it just...
I don't know if that'll get you out of the trunk.
I don't see the intrinsic value. Say, hey, I got some crypto. Will you drive me across the border? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, we'll throw you in the border. Come on.
But isn't it interesting to see that the cachet, no pun intended, the cachet of American stature is that, you know, somebody in a foreign country is willing to take a piece of paper with, you know, with Ben Franklin on it in return for a good or service. You know, if you think about it intrinsically, the paper in your pocket, if you carry cash, is only as good as the fact that somebody's willing to take that in exchange for something else. Mm-hmm. If we don't even think about it, it's almost native to. You don't think about a lot of things that it's just part of the landscape, right? We take a lot of things. It's hardwired into our brain, and at such an early age, dollars are so ubiquitous and so there's so much credibility to this country's rule of law and the fact that the U.S. taxpayer backs it up, that people are willing around the world to take it. I think that's a huge privilege that the United States has. I think we've abused it. I think that it's becoming a problem when we continue to spend $2 trillion more every year than we have. And I do think other countries are waking up to the fact that the United States is abusing its printing press, if you will. And, you know, that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
But getting back to cash on a daily basis. So the Federal Reserve does these studies. It's amazing, the studies they do on. And since the pandemic, prior to the pandemic, you know, in 2017, 2016, person-to-person payments, the most prevalent form was still cash, believe it or not. It was 31% of folks would use cash. Credit cards was 18%, debit cards 27%, and then other types of payments were out there. In 2022, which is the most recent year of the study, it's down to 18% in cash.
Wow.
And credit cards and debit cards are about 30% each. So
I believe it.
It's
I believe it.
Don't you believe that now?
No, yeah? I do, because it seems like whenever I pay in cash, I have to imagine I'm not doing it. Most people are not, because they always have to seem to crack open that coin thing whenever I'm there. And that means usually most people are doing a credit or debit card.
Right.
I get it. And I get that. And then you'll have they're getting the quarters and the pennies out for me. And, I feel like I'm slowing things down now.
Well, do you ever try to negotiate a $100 bill? Not that I do, because I don't, obviously, but they're a pain in the neck to negotiate.
Yeah,
people kind of give you the eye roll.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, what are you doing? Are you flexing here or what?
Yeah.
And then when they get over that, then they think you're a criminal.
Yeah.
And they'll hold it up to the light, and then they put the little pen over it.
Yeah,
you know,
is that pen with the secret juice on it, you know?
I can't tell you, Christine. I would have to put you – I'd put me in the trunk if they did. No.
Yeah.
There's a special type of ink. I actually found a really cool app doing this segment. Jeez, I go down a rabbit hole. Mm. It's called Cash Assist. It's put up by the Federal Reserve, so it's Cash Assist, and it's an app you can get on Android or your Apple phone, iPhone, and it helps you. It gives you about all the security features of all U.S. currencies, and it's really cool. You can use it to, especially if you run a small business,
mm-hmm.
and arm your employees with that, and it gives you tips as to. And I'm sure they know people in a cash business. and as we are in the bank. I mean, our folks are trained to be very suspicious.
No,
of
you do have to be
high denomination bills.
I think you know, obviously, if you're any business, but you know, say you're a mom and pop business, somebody's paying for $100 or whatever, and you get scammed on that or whatever. I mean, that is a problem, and you know, sometimes in a place where there's a lot of transactions going on, it would make you nervous. I can get it. You know, I can get that.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I'll leave you with this last thing. There's a feature that somebody had done an analysis called the denomination effect, and they did this study and they gave college students $100 bill. Some had $100 bill, and the others had 520s. People with the 520s were more apt to spend the money and be satisfied with what they bought. The people with the 100, they typically wouldn't buy anything unless it was of a higher value, say something over $75. Yes. And when they did, the satisfaction of what they bought, they were disappointed.
Yeah.
So it's called the denomination effect. It's got a psychological effect.
No, it is.
I believe it.
That Benjamin,
yeah.
Right? You lose that C note.
When somebody gave you 100, it's like, yeah, it's, well, first of all, I'm embarrassed to use it anywhere, so I end up just holding on to it longer. No, I'm serious, than I would the 20s.
It's true. And just to throw another cog in the wheel here, what about people that get gift certificates? Why does a $20 gift certificate feel like it's worth more than cash?
See?
I do. I feel that way.
Yeah. I like gift certificates and gift cards. Yeah. It is
fun. Send them my way, too. I love them, too, Robert.
I do. Bob Taravecchia, Coastal Heritage Bank. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, gang. Talk to you soon.
As promised, we have a local author in studio with us this morning. It is her first book, and we're going to get a chance to know Mal Wren Corbin. The name of the book is called Raising Wrens, a Memoir. This is her story. And Mal, welcome to WATD.
Thank you so much for having me in studio, Rob.
Absolutely. So this is a powerful story. It is your story about growing up. Kind of fill us in, I guess, why you decided to share and to write it out, because there's some traumatic, painful experiences in here.
Yeah. There's quite a history there growing up in the middle of Massachusetts. And you're right. It's a tough story, but I hope people will find it ultimately to be an inspirational one. And I think I've always felt as if I lived a little bit differently than a lot of people. And ultimately, I wanted to be better known, better understood. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah, okay. So you were born in Worcester, and it says after a turbulent childhood. I mean, this is a story of growing up with very difficult conditions, but turning that around, becoming very successful, first-generation college graduate, something to be very proud of, Bachelor of Arts degree at Dartmouth College, and then a Master of Education degree at Boston College, and now you're a very successful businesswoman, great family life, living here on the South Shore. Who wouldn't want to do that? And now your first book out. I mean, that's a pretty exciting success story. So you would imagine people that knew you very young must be very proud of you.
Oh, don't make me cry 3 minutes into the interview, Rob. But yeah, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. Everyone's been really supportive. I really wasn't sure how it would be received. So I can't say enough about that reaction.
Let's talk about your childhood. Tell us a bit about it, what we're going to read in this memoir. I think a lot of us can go back and we have memories. Some of us had some great childhoods. Some of us not so fortunate. Tell us about what it was like for you growing up in Worcester.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people know Worcester is an old factory town. I grew up there in the 80s, early 90s, and in this particular neighborhood anyway, the Main South neighborhood, it was really plagued by a lot of addiction problems, mm-hmm. a lot of poverty, homelessness, and violence, frankly. And the Wren family, Wren like the bird, but with two N's.
Yeah, raising Wren.
The Wren family, frankly, fit in really well in that area. So those same issues plagued our family as well. And you know, so this is a story of navigating all of those challenges and ultimately finding my way out of that. and reinventing myself a bit, but ultimately also being really proud of where I came from and owning the positive aspects of that family life and those aspects of Worcester that I could leverage in a positive way.
Mm. When you talk about the tough moments and the tragic moments, do you have some great memories about living in the 80s and growing up? What are some of the positive memories you have?
Yeah. There are what I think on the surface might appear to be really tough stories, moments where I was homeless, even living in a friend's closet. But there's something really beautiful about being a child and how resilient children are. And in those moments that are really difficult and sad on the surface, there's also a beautiful innocence and the ability for kids to have fun in those moments and find humor in those moments. Mm-hmm. Things like sneaking root beer from the friend's refrigerator and having that in the closet with you. And we just thought we were hilarious getting away with something real big there. So, you know, those are sweet moments. And spending time with siblings, catching grasshoppers in an abandoned lot. Again, not exactly what you would paint as a beautiful picture, but sweet and touching moments nonetheless.
Mm. So you're on the South Shore now. In writing this book, your memoir, did you do any research? Did you go back to Worcester to kind of take it in to feel like to go to some of the places that you grew up?
Yes, yes. If I'm being honest, I really... As I started to build my own life outside of Worcester, I didn't want to go back. But in my father's passing and ultimately my brother's passing, I, of course, had to go back. Mm-hmm. And once I did, I started revisiting the lots of different apartments that we had lived in. I had lived in about 15 different apartments by the time I was 15. Wow. And as I started revisiting those places, I couldn't stop. It was, mm-hmm. there was something really cathartic about going back, and it did ultimately make me feel like, hey, I want to be back here. I want to own this. Mm-hmm. And there are some positives here too.
So we should mention the book has the tragedy. You lost both your dad and your brother in tragic ways, correct?
That's right. That is true.
That's very difficult. You mentioned that your sister is still with you. She is down in Florida, and you guys stay in touch. But you're the only siblings left.
That's true. And that dynamic with my sister is an interesting one because she was actually adopted at age 5 to another family member. So we didn't grow up together per se, but we have an absolutely undeniable bond that we share between the two of us, for sure.
Well, I'm sure that you have heard and many people talk about when it comes to certain behavior and addictions that it can be a cycle that's very difficult to get out of. And we see it from generation to generation. There could have been a path for you that could have gone one way instead of the one that you're on. What was it, or what do you owe it to? Was there any one person, or was it something you felt that allowed you to get out of it and to go on to this very successful career in education?
Yeah, it's a great question, Rob. No one person, but for all of the really difficult things that I've experienced, particularly early on in life, and frankly, not so great characters that I came across in my life, there have been that many more wonderful, positive people that have been amazing influences in my life. And they may have just stepped in for a moment here. There was a high school teacher that took me in overnight at one point, mm-hmm. and put her career on the line for me. And all of those moments, all of those people have really stitched together a path for me that has led me to this ultimately beautiful life that I've built for myself.
Mm. What are you hoping people will get from the book, Mel? I know it's received some positive reviews so far, and it's gotten a great response. What are you hoping people can take away?
I hope that they can take away that there is a beautiful way forward, that everybody, despite where you come from, what your circumstances are, that everybody is entitled to have a beautiful, healthy, happy family life of their own. And I'm just amazed at how many people I've already heard from that can relate to aspects of my story. They've experienced some similar things, and they seem to find some real comfort in being able to connect with me and share their story, someone they can relate to, and I can relate back to them. And I can't hope for anything greater than that. That's been amazing.
Raising Wren's a memoir, Mal Wren Corbin, and you can find the book, I imagine, in stores and online.
Absolutely, Amazon. And if I could also say, I'll be at the Booked bookstore in Duxbury this Sunday, the 25th, from 3 to 4 p.m. for a book signing. We'll have copies on hand there as well. And if you can't make it, please place an order online. I'd be so grateful.
That's wonderful. So people can see you on Sunday?
And yes, please come
see me. What time
is
the event?
3 o'clock, 3 to 4.
3 o'clock, and that is at?
Booked.
Booked in Duxbury. All right. Again, that is Sunday at 3?
That's correct.
3 o'clock. All right. And people can find out more on your website. It's malwrencorbin.com, MalwrenCorbin. Malwren Corbin. Just Google that and it'll come right up. Raising Wrens. It's the name of her memoir and it's out now. First book. And this, of course, very raw look at her life and story. Do you hope to do more writing, Mal, after this?
We'll see. I'll say this has been a labor of love that has taken me almost 6 years. So we'll see where it takes me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today to share your story with the audience. And we wish you good luck with the book. And thanks for coming in to see us here at WATD.
Thanks for having me in.
It's Mal Wren Corbin. Raising Wrens is the name of the book. The South Shore's Morning News continues. I'm Rob Hackelow with the morning team. Every week at this time, we check in with our tech guy, David Snell, over at Act Smart IT in Wareham. David, good morning to you.
And good morning, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing great. So we're going to talk about drones and satellites and how they may be monitoring our homes. Okay, this is interesting.
Yeah, well, it's pretty interesting. They're not simply monitoring our homes. Some of the major home insurance providers are actually proactively checking people's homes, perhaps people who've already filed a claim against their homeowner's insurance or something. And if they see something that looks amiss on the home or in the yard, they're sometimes sending out a letter saying that based on aerial imagery of your home, this is the reason that we're canceling your policy.
Oh, my. Okay. Because you may not have been truthful about something, correct?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I thought about when I was researching this was that there are many families that have trampolines in their backyard.
Yes, that is true.
You see them all the time.
Yep.
If you didn't add that to your homeowner's insurance, it's a liability, and they could cancel your insurance and not renew it just for that reason.
Uh-oh, I didn't know it was a gift. I didn't know that was in my backyard. Okay, but you're saying, so therefore, I mean, obviously, when you think about it this way, you can't go around and check every house. I mean, sometimes you'd have people do appointments and... you can have people certainly come out to your home, but this is a much cheaper way. I mean, well, in some ways.
Yeah, it's much less expensive for the insurance companies, but it's going to be more expensive for the homeowners or the insurers of these insurance companies. Now, there are three major insurers that we won't mention their name, but they are in my article up on my website, that are actually proactively using technology like drones and aerial photography from satellites to look at homes that they may want to not consider insuring in the future. Wow. I think that's a little bit unfair.
Yeah, it does seem a little bit scary. Oh, those drones from Oblivion, they're scary. That's a good movie. Watch those drones. They'll be that'll be the one that they'll send out when they want to enforce their policy.
Exactly.
Well, okay. So, but you say now, I mean, it does make sense from a company point of view that I could just go and take screenshots, I guess, of your yard and see what's going on. But you could only see so much, right? I mean, could you dispute that maybe or fight that?
Well, the people, this happened to a number of people here in Massachusetts and then across the country as well. And they've tried to dispute it. And the companies themselves have said, no, we're going to go by our aerial photography or our drone footage, and we are not going to renew your homeowner's policy.
Yeah.
So at that point, the only option is to actually find another insurer, probably not one of the three that I mentioned in the article, that are actually using satellite imagery to do this.
Okay. So, I don't know, what advice do you grow trees or what advice do you, I mean, because as you know, if you've ever done this or not, when you Google things on Google Maps, it is fun to look, but I don't know if you've ever tried to go somewhere to some place you haven't been before and you can't see the house because they live in such a forested area and you can see like the dot of like where the address is. Because sometimes, you know, when you go somewhere and you can't see the house at all, maybe that's the way to go.
Exactly. But, you know, you bring up trees, and that's one of the things that people have been ticked for. They have large trees around their home that could eventually fall on the home and cause a claim. So the options are they do not renew the insurance, or you clear the trees. So it's an interesting conundrum we're in here, because insurance companies, as always, are trying to minimize the risk, whether it's home insurance, car insurance, whatever we have, even health insurance. And this is the way that some of these companies are now trying to minimize their risk based on the policies that they have already issued.
Yeah, and it's true. And I was going to say, obviously, you know, you can go and fight the government sometimes with those speed cameras that they've set up, and you hear about, you know, was I driving or was that really my car? But in this case, you're not going up against the government. You're going up against an insurance company. And I guess, as you just stated, they can say that we're going to go with our aerial technology and make that decision to cut you loose. And so, as you said, your only choice is if there's someone else you can go to.
Exactly. And this is perhaps unfair, in my opinion, but it's perfectly legal, because in all of our homeowners' policies, the insurer is able to inspect your property at any time. So they've just decided to do it via aerial photography and drones.
Boy, it's interesting. I mean, it makes sense from a company point of view, but it just seems to be that it adds to more ways of saying no and feeling like it's stacked against you, the consumer. But I suppose some things have been said like that about insurance companies. Again, they shall go unnamed at this point. But you can read more in the article, right?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that brought this up was there was a woman in an older home in Worcester who has a slate roof, who in fact maintains that roof the way it's supposed to be maintained and has for years. And the insurance company said, no, you need to remove it and replace it within 90 days. And that this woman now needs to come up with $30,000 to replace her roof, or she has to find a new insurer. It's tough.
Yeah. You know, I wonder if there will be ways. I mean, again, I'm not saying this would be legal, but we're cameras and satellites, just like they did during world wars, maybe confuse or disguise things that are seen from the air in terms of how it looks like on the ground. Maybe there's a way to fool those things.
I'm quite sure that there are devices out there that can, in fact, mix up those units and even make them crash.
Are you sure it's a slate roof? Take a look again. Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, it looks like solar panels. Okay.
Another thing, solar panels, that has to be added to your home insurance as well, because they drill holes in your roof.
That's true. Make sure you disclose everything, or else we can fine you from the sky. David Snell has more information on his blog, where you can read out more. David, where do people go to read more?
Let's go to xsmartit.com, click on my blog link, and please don't send a drone.
Yes, don't send those drones. All right, David Snell, Oh, it's that angry drone music. ActSmartIT.com. Thank you, David.
Have a good day, Rob.
You too.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. As always, you can find us on your radio at 95.9 FM, mornings from 5 to 10, or online at 95.9WATD.com.
And you can catch up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can get the links at 95.9WATD.com/SS Morning News. And join us next week for another edition of the South Shore's Morning News Week in Review.